Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 22nd, 1995. In a Creekside room this afternoon, our speaker is Don Johnson, and he will be speaking on Making Disciples, a Challenge in a New Life. Let's listen in on Don Johnson.
I suppose it's because one gets in a certain place that you begin to think about, well, how are we doing things? And it's because I've been in Vancouver now for some time that I begin to think about, well, how do we do some things? So before I start talking about this, I want to ask, how many have all of you been in the church all of your lives? All of you baptized as infants? Anyone here not baptized as an infant? At what age were you baptized?
17, over the protest of my parents.
17 over the protest. So it was not a happy occasion.
Oh, it was a happy occasion
right for you. Thing. Right. Sure. Okay. So.
I was 8 or 9. 8 or 9 years old.
Okay. What did they do to prepare you for this baptism? Do you remember?
All I remember about my baptism is that my mother had all four of us kids with the same sweater on.
Disciples are dressed alike.
She found a church that she wanted. I was joining that place.
Yeah, that was basically that day.
Was that a Lutheran church?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So we only have one of us who has gone through it as an adult, and eventually I'll have to ask you a little bit about that.
I had a four-year-old. My granddaughter was baptized when she was four, though. And I don't know how they prepared her, but when after she was baptized, I asked her. I said, "What has happened to her?" And she said, "Jesus came into my heart."
Oh. Wow. Well.
I thought, gee, I think that's a good answer.
Not bad. Not bad. Somebody had done some work, and that's good. So you can roll this tape, okay? My name is Don Johnson, and I'm from Vancouver, and I'm talking about the adult catechumenate. Now, enough about that. You probably heard from many sources, or maybe have read, about the kind of crisis that we face in the church today. We even joke about it a lot. I've been telling this joke for a long time, and at least the Canadian edition of the Reader's Digest finally printed it. And it sort of destroys your own personal joke that you had, but I'll tell it to you anyway. There was three pastors, a Roman Catholic, an Episcopalian, and a Lutheran, who had problems with bats in their belfry. So they met together to say, well, what in the world do you think we could do about these bats? So they decided, first of all, that the Roman Catholics suggested that maybe they ought to shoot them. So one night, they got their rifles, and they went into the Roman Catholic church, and the bats were flying around in the church, and they started shooting. They didn't hit any, but they noticed there was some damage to the plaster, and it probably wasn't a very good idea. So the Episcopalians decided that they should poison them. So they got some poison, which they put in some fruit because they thought that bats would eat fruit. And they got some poison, which they had trapped some mosquitoes, and they put poison on the mosquitoes. But that didn't work either. So finally the Lutheran said, well, I think what we should do is we should baptize and confirm them. So they did, and they never saw them again. So let me ask you one more question. If an adult comes to your parish, what happens to that adult? And with that adult, if that adult is seeking for baptism? Some of you are pastors. Some of you may not be pastors, and you may not know a thing about it. So can you tell me, what is the process used in your church right now if an adult comes seeking baptism? So here's congregation that puts a lot of time and energy into incorporating new members, and particularly then incorporating the newly baptized into the life of the church. It seems to me that part of the thing that we have been doing, as far as Lutherans are concerned at least, with our, and I've checked on it in terms of the Canadian scene, and pastors usually spend from 1 to 10 sessions with people in preparation for baptism. Hmm. From 1 to 10 sessions. I think that that comes from a historical background and a kind of a history of the church and something out of our life. I think, though, that we made a lot of assumptions about people when they did this. We often made assumptions that they would know quite a bit about the Christian faith when they came to the church. We're not sure where they would have gotten that, but we made that kind of assumption. Another assumption that we made, I think, was that everybody who comes to church knows how to pray. We've also made the assumption that everybody has at least heard something about Jesus. They may not know the right doctrine, the Lutheran doctrine, or if it were another church, another doctrine, but so we're quite willing to teach them that, and that would be the doctrine of justification by grace through faith. We know how to recite that, and we teach that very well to people. We teach people about the creed, and we teach people a little bit about the Ten Commandments, I expect. But we live in such a different age right now. It's an age in which people have not grown up within the confines of a Christian culture. We've grown up, most of the people have grown up now without any Christian understanding. Or their only Christian understanding may be an occasional visit to a TV evangelist on television. I had a wedding the other day, and in preparation for the wedding, the groom asked me, would you mind telling me what Christmas is really about? I mean, you just sort of say, oh, well, I mean, surely everybody knows what Christmas is about, but when you think about it, we live in another kind of a society and in another kind of world in which other kinds of celebrations are going on all the time. And we assume that somehow the Christ story is going to be known in everybody's heart and life somehow, even if it's in some Mickey Mouse kind of a way. I have friends who teach at the university. Much of the literature of Western culture is often based on images from the Bible. So he was teaching a particular book with the images were Mary and Joseph. And he said to people, the images are on Mary and Joseph. And they said, who are they? So what's happening is that we are having growing up around us a whole series of people who've grown up with absolutely no concept about the Christian faith, no idea about what the Christian faith is. So that's a part of the crisis, eh? So the kind of question that we have to raise is, if someone comes with no understanding of the Christian faith, where do we begin, and how do we fulfill this kind of task of making disciples, which is what the task of the church is. I mean, Jesus sent us out and said, go you therefore into all the world and make baptize and make disciples and teach. Baptize, make disciples, and teach. And so that a part of the baptismal ministry is, of course, one of making disciples. Those who will follow after the discipline of Jesus. Again, we face another kind of question in our culture. Namely, what are the predominant kind of social values that are being taught within the culture and that one would anticipate that people would pick up and know? I mean, it's wonderful to come to Holden Village, and at least one has a bit of a taste about somebody who cares about creation. there's some kind of at least hints about what it means to live in a community. But what are the basic kind of value systems that are strongly promoted within the society? Pardon?
Do what feels good.
Do what feels good. That's one.
Bigger, better, no improved.
That's another one.
Me first.
Me first. Those who have the most toys. When they die, go to heaven. An enormous sense of materialism. People who don't work are not justified. That our society does not teach justification by grace. We teach justification by work. And if you happen to be elder or unemployed or unable to work for whatever kind of reason, or mother who stays at home, you are not justified as a person. So there's a whole sense of social values that are promoted within our society, which are really contrary to what we think about the call of Jesus. They are really quite, I mean, there are many, eh? The Bible says they are legion, to use biblical kind of language. They are legion. We know very well that one of the easiest emotions to show is anger. And many people, that's the only emotion that they really show, is that they are mad at somebody. What does it mean for such a person who has grown up in a society, grown up in a family, where anger is the primary kind of emotion that is being demonstrated? And what does that mean then for that person to become a disciple? What kind of change would come about? What kind of change could we expect in order that somehow the values of Jesus might be taken on in terms of their own personal lives? I think that this is a part of the crisis that the church faces. Namely, that we suddenly discovered that we thought that we were once the predominant culture. I mean, we used to say Canada is a Christian country. They used to say Quebec is the most Christian of all of the provinces because it is French and because it is Catholic. The lowest birth rate in all of Canada is now in Quebec. The highest percentage of abortion in all of Canada is now in Quebec, in spite of what the Pope says, eh? So that one can continue to sort of think about the nation, about our nation, my nation, as a Christian country. But when it really comes down to it, the church has very little to say in terms of predominating social value. I listen to television occasionally from across the border, and I think that you're in a little bit different situation. It's a little bit more complex, because indeed there are many people who would try to promote a kind of Christian nationalism in this country, and this Christian nationalism is often, I think, often in contradiction to what I think are biblical values. I don't want to get into debate about that. I'm a Canuck who says A, and so please leave me out of the kind of national debate. But I think there's a kind of switch and change that has taken place within our society that has made things very, very different, even different from when I was a pastor. When I first became pastor, I was in Saskatchewan. I went to a rural parish in northern Saskatchewan. I mean, everybody belonged to one of two churches. The pastor was the center of the community, for good or for ill. And it was indeed a Christian town. I used to go into school and I would teach Christian education to all of the Protestant kids. Whenever there was a funeral, it would be in the church. It was a kind of a Christian community. We had all kinds of support for our children. Anybody remember Sunday school papers? Which the church used to produce to hand out to children so that they could take home and read to themselves because it was important. And some of these papers would even find themselves into the life of the school so that every student in the school got a Lutheran Sunday school paper. And everybody said, oh, that's okay, because this is a kind of a Christian community, and I guess it will be all right. Now, that was some 37 years ago. And I realized that that was rural Saskatchewan, and it was really different from where I live right now. But even in rural Saskatchewan, the transformation has just taken place. And I think that it's not just happening in big cities like in Vancouver, or not just happening in the West Coast, but that kind of change has taken place all across the land. So the church has to kind of begin to rethink, well, I think finally rethink many things. I recently wrote an article for our church, National Church Paper, because we're going through restructuring. The church always believes that somehow that salvation will come through restructuring. And if we can restructure one more time, that then everything will be okay. And we'll all be shaped up. And I wrote an article saying that I think that maybe restructuring may be an important issue, but one of the other issues is a kind of a spiritual reformation that needs to take place in the life of the church. And I dared to kind of suggest what that spiritual reformation might look like. I know that there are many people who have written on the question about discipleship and what it means to be a disciple today. I sat down with my parish and we sort of worked on this for a little while, and we said there are five things which we think is required of a disciple today. One is prayer and meditation and Bible reading every day. The second is giving a percentage of your income to help other people. We didn't even say tithe, eh? We just said percentage. The third is regular attendance at church in Eucharist. We didn't even say every week, we just said regular church attendance at church and at Eucharist. Participating every year in some kind of growth thing, either through retreat or an educational program provided for the church, or coming to places like Holden Village, but participating every year so that there can be some spiritual growth for yourself. And what was the last one, the fifth one? B, C, D, E. Oh, I'll think about it. What do you think is required of being a Christian? I don't think we covered the whole base, but it seems to me that what my congregation and I were beginning to do within the church was to raise the question about what does Christ expect of us as Christians in this 20th century, and that we had better start to become clear and explicit about our own expectations of ourselves as Christians. I think that this is a kind of an area that is left up pretty much in the air and is pretty much privatized. There are some things in the church you don't talk about. One thing you don't talk about is how much money you make. That's out. The second, except for the pastor. We talk about the pastor, how much the pastor makes. The second thing you don't talk about is politics. The third thing you don't talk about is your relationship to God and your understanding about discipleship. And where you see yourself right now, and the kind of commitments that you think Christ is calling you to in terms of being a disciple. I think that it seems so fundamentalistic, okay? I mean, it seems so fundamental that we would indeed do that, or that we in the church might begin to think about that, or that we might speak with some clarity about that. I live right next to a Jamat Khana, which is a worship house for the Ishmaeli community. They came over to speak to us about the expectations of what it means to be a member of the Ishmaeli community. We were all surprised and embarrassed and kind of glad they didn't invite us back to say, what are the expectations of a Christian in our community? Prayer 3 times a day. And if you can, come to the worship house. There are 300 people that come to the worship house at 5 o'clock every morning. And there are 700 people who come to the worship house at 7:30 every night. Give 10% of your income. Do good works in your community. Read and study the Quran. Now, I know the Ishmaeli community is a kind of a community unto itself in many ways. It is a community that has been persecuted in Africa and in northern India, and so that they have grown up with a kind of a, well, I think kind of a, almost. They feel like they're a Jewish community in some ways.
Is it an ethnic group, or do they have converts from Vancouver's older popular?
It's a multinational ethnic group. They do not seek converts.
Uh-huh.
No, they do not seek converts. But the one thing you notice about their community is that if there's anybody in the community who is in trouble, there is somebody there to help them. The other thing you know about the community is that if you need financial assistance to start a business, you can go to the elders, and the elders will find the money for you. There is a kind of a sense, wonderful sense of caring for one another. And that not just limited to the inner community, it is also extended to other parts around the world, so that when there are famines and all those kinds of things, which we also seek to respond to, they also try to do this. So then I said to myself, well, if they expect that much of themselves in terms of making a disciple, of being disciples of in Islam, what do I expect? I think that probably, and I have to, I'm a part of this, I mean, I'm just as much a part of it as everybody else, that we kind of have allowed ourselves to become the light church. 24 fewer commitments, home of the 7.5 tithe, 15-minute sermons, 45-minute worship services. We have only 8 commandments, your choice. You use just 3 spiritual laws and have an 800 millennium. Everything you wanted in the church and less. So that as we begin to think about the question about making disciples, do we ourselves have any expectations about what would be expected of a new convert and of a new baptized person in the church? I must be careful when I use the word expectation, because I'm also a strong supporter of grace. I'm a strong supporter of that God is at work here and that God is calling us. But the kind of question that we have to then face is, in what way is Christ calling us today to be disciples? I think that for the most part, and I'm among them, that we have spent a lot of time in which we have let it all hang loose. And you have been able, and we've all asked one another, just to do whatever you were able to do. And a few people have come around and said, well, let's help the poor. Well, if you're able to, that would be really nice. If you've got a few extra dollars, that would be really nice. A few of us have said, you have to be evangelists. Okay, well, yeah, that's okay too. And if some of you can do that, that would be really nice. And a few of us have said, maybe you ought to pray. And yeah, well, okay, there will probably be a few people in the congregation who pray every day and who pray once or twice a day. But it's kind of like it is, has become for us optional. An option. It's sort of like we go to the smorgasbord called discipleship, and we can either eat or we don't have to eat. We can either taste or we don't have to taste. But the one thing we don't want to do is to put any pressure on people. Because if you put pressure on people, that's why we'd rather be in the light church, because if you put pressure on people, then indeed they're going to have to go away. They may leave. Because we live in a society that is does not expect to do anything except look after itself. And therefore the church has to pattern itself after the society in order to gain converts. That's one of the arguments. And it's one of the things I think that's been happening throughout the life of the church, and at least in the church in Canada, and I anticipate throughout the life of the rest of the church. So when we say to ourselves, well, look, what we want to do is we want to make disciples. Church and say, and we know not why they come. I mean, people come to church for the strangest reasons. I had an Islamic person come to our church because he was about to be kicked out of Canada. And he decided that if he was going to be baptized, that maybe the immigration department would have mercy on him. And therefore, if I could baptize him tomorrow, he could take the certificate down and demonstrate that he was a Christian. And as a Christian, he would be persecuted in an Islamic country where he had come from. And therefore, it would be important for him to stay here. Well, we convinced him that probably that wasn't the reason to be baptized. And the truth of the matter is he hung around because we tried to support him, and he went through a process which we call the adult catechumenate. People come for a variety of reasons. People knock at your door for a variety of reasons. People are touched by God, I believe. I believe that God is always out there. God is always out there touching people, offering grace to people. A part of the problem that most people have no idea that God is present and have no vision that God is there and can only really think about the event rather than to also see that God is also present, leading, guiding, directing, caring for, and offering grace. And on occasion, somebody says, aha, maybe this is God. And it's the kind of wonderful aha that comes in a kind of wonderful way, because it's an aha that comes from within, not something that's kind of perpetrated by somebody knocking on the door and saying, have you ever thought about the fact that you might die today? And do you know where your soul might go if you might die today? It's the aha that happens in one's kind of daily life. It's the aha and the gentleness of the spirit that finally catches a hold of people. But I think that that's the kind of thing that's happening in lots of people's lives. To give witness is to go and to witness to the action of God in your life and in other people's lives. To give witness is to call attention to the fact that God has been present in a person's life, and to name that. It is to be a witness to God's activity in a person's life. To give witness is also to give witness to the God who is active in your life. Lutherans are great at thinking that giving witness is learning doctrine, learning ideas, and then going out and spewing those ideas, and then wondering why nobody will pay any attention to them. Lutherans are great at saying, I wonder if I said the right thing. I wonder if I said the right thing. Pastor, did I say the right thing? Pastor, is it okay? Pastor, and most Lutherans say, the truth is, I don't know enough. So therefore, I cannot give witness. We kind of have a kind of head thing going on in our church, a very strong kind of indoctrination kind of thing. And indoctrination is sort of the poorest way in which we can kind of deal with the current crisis in our society. Because indoctrination does not give people freedom. But indoctrination puts people into straitjackets. And what we want to do is in some ways ourselves discover the Christ who leads and guides us. And what we want to do is also help other people to discover that Christ who leads and guides. What's been happening is that the ecumenical church, Roman Catholics, Anglicans, a few Lutherans in the United States, now Lutherans in Canada, have said, one of the things we have to do is maybe look at what was happening again in terms of bringing Christians into the faith in the first centuries of the church. And so Lutherans and Episcopalians, following Roman Catholics who have been into a program and into a project which has looked carefully at that. They've been doing this in North America for the past 25 years. This past year I spent a month of my sabbatical traveling in Europe, and I was in France, and I was in Italy, and I was in Holland, and I went to Roman Catholic churches in each of those countries. It was interesting that on the bulletin boards of every church in their own language was renewal through the adult catechumenate, renewal through the adult catechumenate. So that Roman Catholics all in Europe, Roman Catholics in North America, Episcopalians, and now a few Lutherans are also saying, hey, maybe we better look at what's happening and what happened to the first centuries of the church. Now, Lauren Mead is absolutely right that we cannot go back and reduplicate the first centuries of the church. That was something in itself. But there were some things that were happening in the first centuries of the church which we recognize to be also true for us today. Namely, that we were facing the question of many gods, of many value systems. And people were coming to the church being supported by many value systems. And the early church said, no, no, if you're going to be a follower of Christ, there are some things which you have to denounce. And there are some things which you have to take on. And they had a process of doing this. And the process is a wonderful process, because I think it's a process that is not clerically oriented. Namely, it is not a process for pastors, but it is a process that involves the whole of the congregation. Now, I've been instructed that I'm supposed to talk for 25 minutes, give you 15 minutes for group discussion, and then you're going to give me some feedback. Well, I'm kind of a person that I say all of my talks are sort of like baloney. You can cut them off at any time. And the temptation will be that I will go on and on for a longer period of time than I should. I wanted today to kind of give you some background about why I'm kind of excited about what we're doing and about what I'm talking about. And I think that this has some implications, not just for the baptized, not just for the new people who are coming into the church, but I think that this ultimately has some implications for the whole of the congregation and perhaps the whole of the church in terms of its revitalization. We've got a couple more minutes. So, do you have any questions, or have I sort of numbed you? Yep.
How would you react to a sort of summary expectations in terms of discipleship as living out the Sermon on the Mount?
I think it's wonderful. I think I'd like it to be put into more concrete terms than that. Because the Sermon on the Mount, I mean, every time I preach on it, I kind of say, my goodness, here's a culture that does not like people who mourn. If you are in sorrow or in sadness, or if you are in depression, or if you are a person who is going through deep crisis, that there is some, you are often spurned, eh? We're the people of the happy face. Everybody's got a smile. You got to be happy in our society in order we are justified by our happiness face, I suppose, or something like that. So that the Sermon on the Mount, I think the Sermon on the Mount cuts very, really deeply into our society. And we need to talk about its implications for our lives today. But I agree with you. But there's lots of people who say, like a woman who said to me, well, I'm a Christian, I keep the Ten Commandments, and I sort of wanted to say, well, which one, you know? Yep.
Can you just, in a very brief time or way, describe adult catechumenate, what it means for Roman Catholics in Europe or what have you? Is it more than adult education in a parish?
Oh, yeah, right. Sure, I can. Let me tell you, and I'll go over this again, but let me show you what this might mean. Eh? The early church and the Roman, and us today, all of us today, say the people come to the church and they are inquirers. New people come and they are inquiring about the faith. And that we have to recognize that they have lots of questions to ask, and they have lots of things that they want to kind of do in their lives. So the first thing that you do is that you bring them into a group of people
invite a sponsor to be a part of their life. And they also then meet with the catechist and the sponsor and whoever else is in the organ, who is in the project at that particular time. And their task is to really sort out, hey, do I really want to seek baptism or not? And that's the first phase, the first stage. Allowing people time. How much time would it take for a person? Well, for this Jewish person that you talked about, it was a long time, eh? I mean, he was probably an inquirer for as long as he married his wife. So for some people, that's a very long, long period of time. But there eventually will come a time when they say, hey, I am prepared to seek for baptism. During this time, at least for us in Canada, as we do this, we invite all of these people to meet in a group that simply studies the lectionary. And looks at the lectionary and simply says, what in the world does this mean for our lives today? How is Jesus touching us? How is this word touching us? Now for somebody who has never looked at the Bible before, or for some, that's a really difficult task. It's not a simple thing for people who have not had any experience with the Bible, for them to begin to listen to the language of the Bible, to listen to the language of their own heart, and to begin to say, how do these things interconnect? After a person has decided that they will be a candidate for baptism, they are brought before the congregation and welcomed as a candidate, and then they become a candidate for baptism. They are welcomed by the congregation in a rite, and the rite is a rite of blessing. And the congregation then knows exactly, right from the word go, who are these people, what's happening to them. The congregation is also invited to witness to them about their own faith and to pray for them. So that immediately, right from the word go, the congregation is involved in all of this. And these people then become, during prayer of the church, these people are regularly prayed for. In the Roman Catholic Church, if you are a candidate, you come to Mass on Sunday morning, but you then leave at the time when communion is being celebrated. I just have not ever felt comfortable with that. So in our program, we have it as an option that people could leave, but only come to hear the sermon, hear the prayers, and then when the community is celebrating Eucharist, well, then those people who are preparing for baptism would leave and go off into a discussion group to talk about their business for that particular Sunday. There comes a time when the candidate announces a time of baptism. I will be baptized at such and such a time. And we say they then enter into a more intensive period. So this intensive period in the early church was Lent, because baptisms usually happened at Easter time. And so they said the more intensive period should be 40 days. The early church said this. Because that's what our Lord had to do, is he had to go into the wilderness for 40 days. And therefore, we will have you, during these next 40 days, we will have you intently prepare yourself for baptism. At this point, you have to ask, according to their program and ours too, what does it mean to take on Christ in my life? What is it that I have to renounce? What is it that I have to give up and have to get rid of? And what is it that I now believe? So during this time in the early church and in the program today, the candidates are brought to the congregation two or three times. In the program that we have now in our church in Canada, we bring them before the congregation during Lent twice. And then the first time we give them a
a prayer book of the church and invite them to participate in prayers of the church. Second time, we give them the creed of the church and then ask them also to stand up before the congregation and express their own faith about what they believe and why they seek baptism.
Let me interrupt. When you say the church in Canada, is this more than your congregation?
Okay. It's a national program.
Then comes, so this is a time of intensity, and it can be during Lent.
I like it during Lent, eh? I mean, I think that it's wonderful to have this happen during Lent. We recognize that Lutherans never go by such rules and regulations. So we suggest that a second time, namely that it could also take place during Advent season, yeah, right.
Then baptism takes place at Easter. And then we have to meet for another 50 days to Pentecost. If you're a baptismal candidate, this would be your baptism and Eucharist would be received for the first time, and would be received at this time. So this 50 days is to ask the question, out of my baptism and out of the Eucharist and out of my experience with the scriptures, or however long I've been dealing with this, what is it that I feel that Christ is specifically calling me in terms of my mission? So in our process, we have made the last 50 days an emphasis on priesthood of all believers and on people really asking the question about what is the mission to which God has called me today. So the process is open-ended. People who are sponsors are invited to walk with the person as long as they need to walk. Or if the person somewhere in the program process says, no, I'm sorry, I'm not ready, I'm not interested, let me out of here for a while, then that's the kind of hard thing that both the congregation and the sponsor have to take. But that's the reality, eh? And how to be graceful about that and gracious about that and inviting, you know, to be open to say, well, you know, if you change, we still want you to come to church, and if you want to change your mind anytime, you're certainly welcome to come back. All of those things need to take place, because it will happen that people will finally say, no, I don't want this. This is not for me, or not for me at this time. Thank you very much. I mean, I knew a university professor who said, you know, I think I would like to be a follower of Christ, but I know that I don't want to pick up the cross. Thank you very much. I'm going to do it. I said to him, God bless you.
I have a question about how do you relate this now to your regular confirmation classes with your teenager? What have you done differently? I mean, how does that compare?
Oh, I still teach confirmation class like everybody else. Only I tried to change confirmation class a little bit and to make it a little bit more spiritually focused than doctrinally focused. A little bit more focused in terms of some of the issues that they face in their lives rather than the issues that I think they ought to be facing in their lives. So here's a team. A sponsor, a catechist, someone who is the organizer, takes three people in a congregation, at least, to run a program, and a pastor. All of these people have an important role, but suddenly baptismal ministry and bringing people to Christ is not just a ministry of the pastor, but it also becomes a ministry of many of the laity of the church, and also becomes the ministry of the whole congregation, because the whole congregation is also involved in the life of the church.
So is the catechist a teacher then? Is it a one-on-one, one-to-one teaching?
Nope. Meeting in a group.
Oh.
meeting in a group, but the sponsor meeting one-to-one with the candidate.
So, I have a couple of videos that I brought with me because we've been trying to make a couple of videos to kind of promote the program in Canada and help congregations to understand it. And these videos are somewhat made. They're not finished yet. In those videos, you will get a chance to see, if you wish, the relationship of some of the candidates to the sponsors. And it's really quite wonderful. I mean, this year we had no candidates for baptism. We only had candidates for affirmation baptism. People who said, hey, I need to get deeper in the faith. One of the candidates this year was a guy named Matthew, who has been working at Holden Village here for the past few months. Matthew was a university student, and he got drunk one night, fell out of a sixth-story window, landed on a motorcycle, and lived. And I went to see him in the hospital, and I said, God has some important purpose for you, Matthew. I don't know what it is. And Matthew now says, I just had never thought about God in my life. I just said, hey, I'm self-made, I'm on my way, I don't have to worry about God at all. And all of a sudden, it came down on me, eh? And so Matthew decided that he would join this process. And he had a sponsor named Bob. Bob was a university professor at Simon Fraser University. And Matthew was 21 years old. He and Bob met together every week, or met together, went for walks, did some praying together. And Matthew grew in the midst of all of that. The one other thing about this whole thing, Sammy, just go. I mean, I can talk about it for a long time. But the other thing about this is that you don't really have to buy a lot of books. I mean, the agenda is the lectionary, the Sunday morning lectionary, and the agenda is people's lives. And so, Oxford Fortress has been a little bit reluctant to promote some of the material that we printed up about the adult catechumenate. We're not sure why. Some say that because they don't like the adult catechumenate, so therefore they're not promoting our stuff. And so we're having to hawk it ourselves these days. But I think that maybe one of the reasons that the Oxford Fortress doesn't really like the adult catechumenate very much is that it is not a curriculum. In fact, you could get by without buying anything. I mean,
it's a practical question, but it gets at, I think, a really important point. Let's just have a scenario of a new mission start, and you have a Lutheran pastor somewhere in Canada, and he's calling on homes, and he's getting new members. Someone comes with a letter of transfer from another Lutheran church. This is a baptized, confirmed Lutheran.
Oh, yeah.
Is this person going to be invited into this program?
You can if you want.
Okay, but from the start, you've got some people who come through a kind of rigorous program, and some people who come in with the whole level of commitment that church membership means anywhere. So from the start, you have a mix, or you're in a traditional parish, and the majority of the people are there with a typical constitution understanding of membership, and now you have some of these new people who have decided to carry the cross, and I'm just asking for the practical nature of the...
Well, I mean, as you know, I mean, the early church always said, the adult catechumenate, the people who go through the process, will always reform the church. A friend of mine named Mike has been doing adult catechumenate for 3 years in Kitchener, and he had six people who were only doing affirmation of baptism this past year. And they finished the process of Pentecost, and they all sat down together, and they wrote a letter to the church council, and they said, we have decided that following Jesus is very serious, and we are looking for tasks to perform in this congregation that are that seem really important for you as a church council. So would you please tell us, what are the things that you would like us to do in this parish as disciples of Christ? Mike said his church council just hit the roof because they'd never had a request like this before. They'd never thought of anybody taking the faith that seriously before. The first meeting, they kind of laughed it out. The second meeting, they decided to take them seriously and discovered they didn't know what to say. So, what I discover, my discovery is that it doesn't appreciate the congregation immediately. You have to have patience, eh? But there are people who are touched emotionally when people like Matthew stand up and say, I am going to college this year, and I've decided through my experience that Christ is calling me to be in a cell group where there will be Bible study and prayer. And that during my next 3 years of education, I will either join such a group and try to contribute to it, or I will form such a group in the college where I'm going. That is what I think Christ is calling me to. I mean, his mom came up and said, Matthew's really serious about this stuff, isn't he? And his dad said, I think maybe I ought to go through that adult catechumenate stuff myself to discover what I ought to be doing. And I think that that kind of thing is happening, but it will take some time. Some time.
But all people seeking baptism would come through a similar process.
Right.
Okay.
All people seeking baptism come through the process. Mm-hmm. People who are transferred, I say, we have, here's some hopes for our congregation. Here's some of the things our congregation has said about discipleship. Mm-hmm. I give them the list, eh? Mm-hmm. Here are some goals that our congregation has for the coming year. Some goals and objectives that we have. I give them that list. Would you like to be a part of this? Mm-hmm. And try to make it very clear about any of that kind of thing. And then I also inform them about the adult catechumenate program and about the kind of thing which how this might touch their lives spiritually and change their lives in some way, and that they are invited to join at any time if they so desire. But I don't make it a requirement for membership.
There's an early July in Seattle, they had a 60,000 men who were gathered together in the Kingdom for an organization, with an organization called Promise Keepers.
Right.
And you're probably acquainted with that they also exist in Canada. But this is something that seems to be sweeping the country, where men have gathered together in masses like this in very large groups. Right. And getting deeply into what it is to be a disciple, what it is to really get into the Word, and let the Word get into them. I wasn't able to go, but I know quite a few more people who did go, which is pretty denominational. But with a strong commitment on the part of Roman Catholic and Lutherans.
Right. Part of that. I think all of that stuff is probably very important. I worried about all the Promise Keepers. I was a little bit worried about them being a bit angry.